was at, the night before the big show, and you know, as seemed to be the case on every damn WrestleMania, got hammered, but accidentally that time. I mean, the other time was on purpose, but.
Welcome back to Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, the podcast from the Hit Vice TV series where we plunge into the Dark Side archives to uncover wild and heartfelt testimonials from some of pro wrestling's most storied characters, which have until now never been broadcast. I'm Jack Encarnacio from the Lapsed Fan Wrestling Podcast, joined by my Lapsed Fan co-host JP Sorrow, as well as Dark Side of the Ring's executive producer and co-creator Evan Husney. Don't forget, Dark Side of the Ring Season 5 premieres Tuesday, March 5th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Vice TV with 10 all-new episodes. Well, this will be a challenging one. Anyone who saw the Season 4 Dark Side of the Ring episode, The World According to Marty Jannetty, Jannetty, of course, being the former WWF star of the late 80s and early 90s who famously teamed with all-time great Shawn Michaels in the tag team The Rockers and certainly partied like a rocker the entire time, knows that Marty Jannetty truly lives in a world of his own, a world in which you are tempted to say truth is stranger than fiction, but the problem is you have to discern the truth first. So Evan is joined today by Stu Stone. Stu is a producer on Dark Side of the Ring who interviewed Marty Jannetty over 3 days, I believe, in Georgia to produce the episode. So guys, let's get right into it. Tell us what it was like to wrangle Marty Jannetty and to get his story down.
This is a very special episode because I feel like, although, you know, Stu did the interview, which we'll get to in a minute, it was like this episode, you know, working with Marty Jannetty, trying to tell this story, trying to get our heads around it. It was like he is the dark side end boss, you know?
Yeah. Like a reason the episode came last in the season.
Exactly. Exactly. Like everything we've learned along the way, separating fact from fiction, you know, our kayfabe detectors and radars, you know, sort of going off. This was the most difficult because this is a portrait of a man who does live in somewhat of a fantasy world, who's perpetuating a fantasy world in his post wrestling career. You know, the spotlight has faded away and, you know, he in kind of ways to remain, you know, relevant, provocative. Here he is on Facebook, you know, putting out murder allegations, among many other salacious things on the internet. And it's our job to kind of figure out, you know, what's real and what's not. So that was the task. And of course, I remember we were producing, I think it was season three. We were in the middle of producing when the story broke that Marty had maybe admitted to a murder, you know, on social media.
Yeah, when you said murder allegations, it's not Marty alleging someone else murdered somebody. It was him sending a post that would indicate that he, in fact, once did murder someone, as the episode explores.
Right. Thank you for that. Yeah. So when that news broke, big qualifier there, it was kind of like, I remember it was just the immediate reaction from the wrestling fan base was like, you know, Marty Jannetty, Dark Side of the Ring episode. And, you know, and so it was something that was definitely on our radar and something we definitely, as soon as had the opportunity to get going again on the next season, we immediately looked into. And of course, you know, as our production staff has expanded and, you know, we have, you know, many producers that work for us in different teams and stuff, you know, Stu is part of, you know, the A squad. And we sent, of course, Stu, we couldn't send anybody else. Stu had to be the one to go and actually spend the time with Marty Jannetty. So Stu, what was that like? You're on the line.
Yes, I am on the line. And thank you very much, Evan, because working on this show is quite an adventure, as I know you can attest to. So being thrown into a swimming pool to swim with Marty Jannetty is a task that I felt up to. I appreciate you trusting me with such an important task as it was. First of all, growing up, being a Rockers fan, a wrestling fan, a Marty Jannetty, you know, fan, it was kind of cool just to go and experience what's this going to be like, just based on what, you know, what we were looking at going into this. Like, you know, before we went on this trip, there was a meeting with Evan and myself and a few other people just sort of describing like what might happen with Marty over the course of a few days.
If he pulls out a firearm, this is what you do. No, I'm just kidding.
Like a whole sort of like, what if this happens? What if that happens? So we already just showing up to like rural Georgia where he was, I guess it's not that rural, but Columbus, Georgia, which is like, you know, a couple hours away from Atlanta. At least I don't remember how long the drive was. But anyway, pulling in there, there's already like a nervous sort of energy of what's going to happen. Like what version of Marty are we going to get? So the first encounter with him, immediately you're whatever nerves you have about what's he going to do are sort of squashed because he's wheelchair bound immediately. That's the first thing you notice is that, you know, you kind of feel bad for him, like right off the bat. You know, he's got his ankle is, as if you watch the episode, his ankle is, you know, vile to look at.
Yeah. He's got some sort of like, you know, his ankle is swollen. And you see it right in the beginning of the episode. And of course, you know, what you also see is you interviewed his childhood friends who are also doctors, and they sort of attest to like, well, I think you asked the doctors who knew Marty, you know, ever since childhood, on a scale of 1 to 10, what kind of pain is Marty in on a day-to-day basis?
The doctor like snap called it. He was like 12. Like he didn't even think about it. It was like, this guy's in 12 and you believe it, you know? But also right off the bat, like Marty is a charming guy. Like he is a likable guy. He's a charming guy. He's friendly. Like he's super, you know, like right away, he's your friend. You know what I mean?
Right.
He has this vibe about him where he sucks you in, and right off the bat, you just like him. So, you know, it's not until we start getting into the details of the interview where like you start to sort of go on a crazier journey. But that first impression of Marty was, you know, I felt immediately he was a sympathetic figure to me because he was like wheelchair bound. His ankle was grotesque. Yeah. He seemed like such a nice guy.
It's wild, JP, to see him depicted all these years later. I mean, we certainly grew up on the Rockers. It sounds like Stu and Evan did as well. Your sort of sense, you know, where you had Marty in your mind as far as after he had left the limelight, you know, what was it like for Marty Jannetty? And then taking in this episode and coming to terms with where he's at, what was your takeaway as a childhood fan of Marty Jannetty?
I was a childhood fan. In fact, you know, when the Rockers were a tag team, I actually favored Marty over Shawn Michaels. He was the guy that I preferred. And, you know, so for me, when I was a kid, he was always my uncrowned Intercontinental Champion after they broke up. Although I don't know if they could ever have, you know, it doesn't, you know, WWE World Champion Marty Jannetty just doesn't sound right. So I don't think that would have ever really come to pass. But, you know, at the time he was my preferred Rocker. And I was always upset that he was, you know, I didn't know why he was coming and going, but he kept coming and going between 92 and 93. And all I wanted him to do was beat Shawn Michaels and win the Intercontinental title. And when I watched this episode, I knew he had drug problems. I knew he had stories. I knew he had demons. But the thing that really took me aback was his lack of accountability. I really can't stand it when people just blame everything else, but don't look. And I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, factors that brought him to where he is, the external factors that he had no control over, but there certainly seem to be many factors that he had a lot of control over, but he's not willing to accept it. He's just willing to be a victim.
Well, you had Al Snow in the episode, his former tag team partner, saying exactly that. I mean, it's right there in the episode. Someone who was his colleague and someone who knew him intimately saying exactly what you're saying, JP. And Stu, having read through the transcript, I know that Marty starts saying GAT before he explains what GAT is.
Yeah, I thought he was talking about the gun, and that's when I was like, uh-oh, that's the talk Evan warned us about. Fortunately, it was just his slang term for God's amusement toy, which he believes he is. And I think you guys nailed it, and I think, you know, Al certainly described it the same way. I feel like it didn't take long for me to figure that out just talking to him, that, you know, every one of these stories that I'm sure we'll get into some of them, but involve, like, decision-making on Marty's part. You know, obviously there is stuff that happened with him and Sean, and there's other stuff I'm sure we'll get into. But yeah, you guys are 100% right on the fact that he does not take responsibility. And you'll find that not just with him. it seems to be a phenomenon with a lot of these guys.
That's true.
Who, you know, and we've spoken to a lot of these guys over the years of making this show, and a lot of them are like that. But Marty is like the final boss of that.
And just before we get into the clips and, you know, start playing some of those, the things that didn't make air for the episode, this was a very unique experience, too, because, you know, listening to some other of Marty's interviews and, you know, he tends to ramble and, you know, he spins a yarn, tells a tall tale. And I just imagined that this interview was going to take a while. You know, I just had a feeling that it was going to diverge and we'd get tangential stories, things we didn't ask for, of good and bad.
Boy, did he deliver on that, Evan.
Yes, he did. He did.
Did you guys come in expecting, you know, we're going to have to go to his associates, his close friends and people around him and sort of what you did forward the narrative that, you know, a lot of the things he says, even his close friends don't trust? Or was that a decision made after he gave you 3 days worth of, you know, specious tales potentially, which, you know, we can't put him under a more strict microscope than everybody else. I mean, if you're in pro wrestling, you know how to tell a story, how to tell a tale. But, you know, was that a decision you guys made because, look, I don't know if we can trust everything he said, or was that just like, you know, what people volunteered when you talk to people close to him?
Well, I have to give a lot of credit to our story producer, Tara Hughes, who worked on the episode. She spent a lot. She's a saint and spent a lot of hours on the phone with Marty Jannetty. I mean, she kind of became like his, you know, maybe there might have been a few wellness checks she had to make, or, you know, they were very close on the phone and developed a very tight bond before we started filming this episode. You know, God bless her for that. And she, so she had a lot of patience for Marty and spent a lot of time with him on the phone, sort of, finding out who were the people that were closest to him, who did know him, you know, for more than just a handful of years, or someone maybe outside of wrestling. So, you know, when you're talking about Mike Moran, you know, who's known him for a very, very long time, or his, you know, pseudo wifey, you know, in the episode. And, you know, they've been sort of lifelong boyfriend, girlfriend, on and off. And
yeah, he uses the term wifey, by the way, just quickly. He uses the term wifey to describe a girlfriend because he doesn't like the term girlfriend. So if you hear him say wifey on this episode, you know what that's about.
Oh, yeah. He's got his own vernacular. Yeah, for sure. So we knew that would be important, like getting people who knew him best in order to help us decipher between fact and fiction was crucial. But going back to what I was saying just about the length of what this interview was going to be, and just knowing that, you know, throwing Stu like right in the front lines of this, it was like, if we could spend 3 days with Marty, you know, which is basically three times longer than we do with any of these interviews. All these interviews are just 1 day usually on the show. So this was unprecedented, spending this much time with a single subject in order to get the full story. So it's a lot of Marty.
You could have cut like 6 episodes out of this interview. I mean, there and tell 6 different complete stories because he gave so much. The interviews were all day, man, all day. Not just that. I convinced him to go out in the world with us into his universe. Like, it felt like we were shooting like a Netflix true crime doc. Like, that's the vibe that I had from it. Like, we were spending time with the guy from The Jinx or something. That's kind of like what it evolved into. Because it wasn't like, it was unlike any other interview. Maybe a handful would qualify as crazier than normal. But this one was, like Evan said, it was the first of its kind for this show, for sure.
Well, let's dig in. We've got the Rockers, okay? This is one of the more famous tag teams of the late 80s and early 90s in the WWF, Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels. And they premiered for the promotion in 1987, and they were only there for 4 weeks before, as the Dark Side of the Ring episode dramatizes, they were fired for acting up and basically living up to their reputation as Midnight Rockers, as they were known before coming to WWF, throwing glasses and other things at a bar and really acting in a way that didn't please the WWF officialdom, and so they're gone. And in between time, Marty tells the story about how Shawn Michaels in particular was really down as they kind of had to migrate to smaller circuits and start over again after getting a taste of, you know, the most prominent wrestling organization in the world. And this really, I think, illustrates sort of the lifestyle that the Rockers had and,
gives us a peek behind the relationship between these two, which will be so central to Marty's entire career story and in the episode, in fact. So they're living together in an apartment complex. And if you read Shawn Michaels' book, he is really down in the dumps and he is really depressed at this particular point in time. When that's brought up by Stu to Marty, he has a particular factor that he points to as why Shawn may have been down in the dumps.
Well, I tell you what he was really upset with. I had my girlfriend with me at the time. We were living, and that was another thing. Even when we moved anywhere, we always got in the same apartment complex. his apartment complex was one building over. Me and my girl were, right there, being 100 feet away. But I'd go over on the days we'd have off. I'd go over, and we'd sit and do cocaine and watch, we did a lot of film studying. Still at that point, we watched hours of wrestling, write notes, and talk about stuff, and do some cocaine. And
Stu, I got the sense reading the transcript that it was pretty much a countdown until he brought up cocaine in just about every story.
Yeah, lots of cocaine, lots of exotic dancers, and then more cocaine.
I mean, for hours and hours. And then, about 4 or 5 in the morning, so the sun's going to be coming up, and my girlfriend's, after we did that several nights, that she's like, you got to stop leaving me alone. You're on the road all the time. And now when you're home, you're over there with Shawn. I'm never, you can't do it. So, I would have to leave him at 3 or 4 in the morning, usually whenever the cocaine ran out. And he used to hate it. He told me one time, he goes, man, I just sat there, wish I had a gun. And so coming down from cocaine anyway, if you don't have like some Valiums or something to bring you down slowly, it's the worst coming off of it, or some alcohol or anything to, you just go to that crash. What was that Tom Petty song? Learning to fly, but I don't have wings. Coming down is the hardest thing. Oh, man, it's so horrible. He told me, he goes, man, when you leave me tonight, man, you can't leave me to come down by myself. I said, well, I can't sit here and come down with you. Two of us going to come down, which we had done that in hotel rooms.
Yeah, it's something, Stu, to hear him talk about the codependency, I guess you could say, because if you're going to wrestle as a tag team like that, have that reputation, be those heartthrobs, and get that fucked up all the time, you kind of depend on the other to be there, right?
100%. I mean, I got that right off the bat. And like the cocaine use was, it sounds like it's not just like casual.
Yeah.
Everything in moderation, Bubba, not that. It sounds like, days and days of benders staying up for 3 days. Like that's going to mess you up. And yeah, I could totally get that vibe that, Marty and Shawn were probably dependent on each other, not just for getting high, but coming down together too. And I could totally see I believe everything he's telling me here, because it just seems, that sounds real. And after hearing him sort of describe the drug use like that, it makes me wonder, like, why do people even do this? Like, it doesn't sound like a good time.
No.
It's not a good advertisement for it anyway.
And one thing to me that was clear about, like, with the episode, once the footage came in and we're sort of starting to figure out, okay, how are we going to tell a story? And it was a big theme to me was sort of imagining it like a rock and roll biopic of a band, like, this is going to sound corny, but it's like, like a, Mick and Keith, a Jimmy and Robert, kind of connection where it's lead singer, guitar player, and they just kill it for fucking 7 years and they're inseparable creative force, that's interconnected and they are codependent. They do everything together. Marty talks about that. But then it's, of course, one member of the band leaves, and he goes on to this much, much bigger solo career than the other person had, and he's now out of the spotlight. And we sort of drilled down on not only that, but thematically looking at the barbershop window, which I know we'll talk about later, but that barbershop window moment as sort of the main visual motif of Marty flailing, and never quite recovering from that moment.
I love the idea of Marty and Shawn taking notes.
Yes, of matches.
Right. They're watching matches on videotape or, God, please, on like a celluloid, with a film projector going. All right. And they've both got on spectacles and like
in the complex in the one bedroom,
right? In the one bedroom complex, they've got this thing. And they've got like notebooks and notepads loaded with notes. And they just scribble things down like constantly as they're watching film.
One thing I did notice that about like from speaking to, you know, Marty's colleagues and Marty himself, and is about as far as Marty and Sean goes, is that like Sean really did learn the game from Marty. Like, yeah, you know, Marty took him under his wing. Marty taught him how to work, so to speak. Marty taught him how to party, I'm sure. You know, yeah, when he met, he describes him as this like sort of quiet kind of nerd kind of guy from Texas. And he sort of took him under his wing and sort of showed him the ropes, good and bad. But even when you watch old clips, like I know in the episode they show old Rockers promos, like Marty's the one cutting the good promo of the two. Like you can see, like Marty's the one, you know, sort of doing the chain wrestling. But it's like a big brother, little brother kind of thing. And then the little brother like gets better than the big brother, like the teacher student kind of vibe. You know what I mean?
Totally comes across. And that's sort of the sense I think wrestling fans have in general of what happened to the Rockers. But this episode and the work you guys did put so much color and texture behind those little moments where there's a slow distancing between the two. Here's one example, perhaps. WrestleMania 6, of course, took place in 1990 at Sky Dome in Toronto. It's one of the bigger events the WWF ever did, and the Rockers wrestled on that show. But Marty talked to you guys about how he ended up in a situation where he essentially had to hitch a ride to the biggest event on the calendar year because, to your point, he just ends up in these situations where he doesn't know where he is when he wakes up in the morning. He's next to a new wifey, perhaps. And in this case, Shawn Michaels is already gone from the hotel. And as far as Marty can tell, has actually taken Marty's bags with him, assuming he's not going to come back to the hotel, and he might as well get his bags to the venue to meet him. But for Marty, the adventure is just beginning in Toronto.
It was back before the big show. And, you know, as seemed to be the case of every damn WrestleMania, got hammered, but accidentally that time. I mean, other time was on purpose, but I ended up with some girl that morning when I woke up. She had left me a note. She had to go to work or something. It was a note on the table, you know, saying, you know, I had to go to work. I won't be back, but I don't know where the hell I'm at. And it's, you know, it's 11:30, 12. I got to be at the damn Sky Dome by 1. Some girls at the hotel, they knew all the boys that were stayed there. Y'all would know the hotel. I just can't think of it right now. But I think I rode with them once I got to the hotel. Now I jumped in with them. And something went wrong with the girl's car on the way to the arena. Something broke down on the side of the road. I'm like, man, God. I panicked, man. I'm going to be late for WrestleMania. What the hell? I can't remember exactly who, but somebody else. I'm on the side of the road with the car. I think steam was shooting out of the radiator or something. And then somebody goes by, it's Marty Jannetty. And I'm like, hey, give me a ride, because they were heading that way direction. You know, I jumped in the car with them and went to the because my bag wasn't there. I'm hoping, you know, Sean brought it, but.
Wait, so you hitchhiked with fans to WrestleMania?
No, I didn't hitchhike. I was standing on side, you know, watching, looking at the car. I ain't got no tools to fix it. I mean, I don't know.
So you got a ride to WrestleMania 6. You got a ride with fans.
I got a ride from getting a ride. You know, on the side of the road, just sitting there, and somebody rode by and hollered. I'm like, hey, come here. So I'm going. So he pulled over and back on down that thing and jumped in there. And then when I finally got there, it was not late, not that bad. And yeah, that was my bag. I was so happy to see that. But that's my night before WrestleMania 6 experience.
A ride from getting a ride. That's pretty much the Marty Jannetty story.
He has so many stories of cars breaking. Like he had like Kurt Angle matches like in SmackDown 15 years later, same kind of gimmick there with like the car break. He has a lot of those type of stories. But full disclosure, I was in the front row at WrestleMania 6 in Toronto.
Oh, wow. And Marty
Jannetty gets thrown over the barricade, like landing where me and my sister are sitting. So I remember like that show, like that was like a huge life moment for me as a fan and as a young person altogether. So to hear the story of him getting the show is surreal to me that he was like,
you saw him that day later, a few hours later.
It's crazy. Thank God that got picked up at the side of the road.
Oh, my God.
But, you see, it's not his fault, though.
Well, that's true.
You know, because, you know, it's not his fault that he got completely wasted. He said it was by accident. And it's certainly, and therefore, it's not his fault that he couldn't get a ride.
Certainly not his fault that the car broke down.
Certainly not his fault.
Do these things contribute? Like, obviously, we've all heard the stories of the Rockers breakup, which is inevitable. You know, it's coming after this.
Oh, yeah.
These are the type of stories that make you kind of like think, well, wait a minute. This is why. never really thought of it like that. You know, Sean's always been the heel in the story that I've, you know, the narrative that we've always heard. But yeah, I mean, if your partner keeps fucking up like this, like, how long do you want to do this for?
I think what's very evident out of that story, you know, which I think is puts a ding in Marty's, you know, camp, is the fact that Sean left with his bag. To me, that says a lot, you know, where he's like, this fucking guy again, I better take the goddamn bag. And I think that says a lot about what Sean's having to put up with at this point, for sure.
The crazy part also is like the amount of like drugs and alcohol these guys are using. And like, they're like athletes, you know, like they're in the ring for trying not to kill each other. And it's like, who even knows what mind frame these guys are, whether they're up, they're down, or in between. Like, it's like watching these old matches after doing the show, you watch it from a whole different perspective.
Yeah.
And Marty specifically, you know, you watch that WrestleMania 6 match now knowing what you know. And it's like, wow, how is he even running to the ring? You know what I mean?
And it's really a point in time where in the business, because Vince is nationalizing the industry and it's not broken up into regions as much as it used to be, these wrestlers are having to fly across cities and just live a completely different lifestyle than, you know, driving town to town, having reliable days off every week. Now these guys are having to rely, or at least they're coming to rely on drugs to get up and get down, to fall asleep when they have to get awake when they have to. And it's, and the amount of travel and the amount of logistics and the amount of air miles they're putting in is just not what they experienced breaking into the business. Yet they import the habits, you know, of being youngsters breaking into the business and, you know, being recognized in clubs and bars and I'm sure having very easy access to women and things like that. So that's happening too. In fact, 87, the year we just talked about that the Rockers were fired, was the first year that the WWF implemented drug testing, only for cocaine at the time, but it was because they had a series of incidents where wrestlers were you know, found acting up in public, and that was certainly the drug pointed to as
the common denominator. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That was the one they really wanted to address. And so it's another thing that Dark Side of the Ring has illustrated over the seasons. I think back to the Road Warriors episode, you know, when you have a tag team in pro wrestling, your fates are intertwined, you know, with Animal. If Hawk was, you know, completely blasted out of his mind, that hurt Animal's career. That hurt his ability to earn a living because all of a sudden nobody wants him as a single. And the fact that there was this divergence between Marty and Sean, you know, speaks to their abilities. I think Stu put his finger on it to keep getting booked, to keep good relations with the office. But Sean wasn't totally, you know, without his issues as well, which
I'm not
Marty
gonna say, right. It's like, it's crazy because to see what Sean goes on to, and like, we know that it's like well documented, like, you know, his drug use in the late 90s during his big run. Like, it's not like he stopped doing drugs. It's like,
in fact, we'll get to the Rumble 93 here after this next clip, which is a key example of what you're saying.
Can I comment on one thing? I'm so sorry to go back. You just brought up the Road Warriors just real fast and then we'll move on.
Yeah, sure.
You know, when you were talking about how they're, you know, linked, you and your tag team partner are one in this. If one is, something happens to one, it affects the other. But also, it's something I learned from the Road Warriors episode, which also applies here, is it's also your identity. It is who you are in this business. And when you no longer have that other half, and I think in the case of Marty Jannetty, it's much more extreme because Sean was able to make his own identity. If you look at how he evolved into WCW and into his runs back with the company in WWF, he's just that rocker guy.
You're right. He never had his own sort of identity.
He never innovated past, like that sort of very dated rocker guy, you know?
And so, I mean, even to the point where he used the music for his entire WWE career. He used the same music.
Yeah. You know? So that's, I think that was his identity as this tag team, and it never ended from that moment forward.
And for those who may be listening to this that don't know this, I mean, to be the Marty Jannetty of a tag team is sort of shorthand in pro wrestling for being the one of the two who didn't break out into single superstardom and become a marquee attraction in their own right. So every tag team has a Marty.
Which Jannetty. Is funny because I asked Al Snow, who was the Marty Jannetty of the New Rockers?
I'll have to think on that one. I think we have two Marty Jannettys there. But so it all happens in the barbershop. You've heard reference to this. It's well depicted in Dark Side of the Ring. This is an angle. This is a storyline that they cooked up in 1992, where a talk show segment called The Barbershop, hosted by Brutus the Barber Beefcake, has the Rockers coming face to face because there had been tensions developing during matches between the two. You could tell it wasn't all good in the hood as it regards these two. And so they have a lot to hash out. Shawn Michaels is taking on a more cocky demeanor. He's got a leather jacket on. He's smirking. He's snapping chewing gum. You can tell this guy is looking to break out on his own. And they have a moment where they, you know, confront this tension, and Shawn acts like he's going to make up with Marty and then famously kicks him in the face and turns on him once and for all. So we know Shawn's now the bad guy and Marty is to be the good guy. And he gets thrown through a plate glass window that was set up on the barbershop set. And as Marty told Dark Side cameras, he actually got quite a rude awakening because there was a setup in which that was supposed to be what they call sugar glass, which shatters much more easily and doesn't cut. But at least according to Marty Jannetty, that's not the window he ended up smashing his head through.
How you gonna claim you got sugar glass window? Why are you bleeding? Right? And I, when I see it, you know, running down, it wasn't horrible, but I seen it dripping off the end of my nose. On that side of the window, it's dripping on the floor, and I didn't feel it, you know, so I'm thinking, well, how the hell did it get cut?
Because it was real glass.
Well, I mean, you know, came up, we finished the segment, went in the back, and, you know, everybody was like, good, 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 that was great, it was good. And one of the production guys comes up, and he goes, are you okay? And it was just a little bit. And I'm like, yeah, man, shit. And he goes, oh, thank God. He goes, please don't tell on me. Don't tell on me. I guess he thought I knew. I said, don't tell on you for what? What are you talking about? He goes, well, we had three windows. You know, one was a real glass and two were sugar glass. But somebody forgot to mark them. He said, we figured we had two out of three chances of getting it right. And they got it wrong. That was real glass. That's why I was cut. And the only thing I did was a little cut here, and then where I was laying over the, you know, over the window sill, there was some little fragments in the belly area. But all in all, he was scared to death too. And I'm like, oh, fuck it, man. There's no harm, no foul. Don't worry about it. And he was so happy because he figured that's it. He's. But I thought about it. I was like, well, what if it would cut my jugular or something? I mean. You know, I didn't say that to him because he was so upset. But I mean, what I wonder what his thinking was. Like, well, if it cuts his head off, at least I got my job.
JP, every 1992 WWF fan almost witnessed the guillotining of Marty Jannetty, apparently.
That seems like a major mistake for someone to make. Why would there be a real glass thing if the whole gimmick is to just break it away? Like, I mean, I know those TV tapings were like crazy marathons, but how many barbershop segments did they tape?
I don't know how you guys felt about it. I know you've seen the angle as well. I always felt like that really shatters like pane glass. It doesn't burst into a million teensy pieces like the sugar glass we see sometimes in wrestling when a guy breaks a, you know, a glass bottle over somebody's head and you can kind of tell. I'm no glass expert. I'm not a glazier or anything like that. But Stu, what did you think of that story as he walked you through a really famous moment?
Watching that segment with Marty was surreal. You know, like, as a kid, you don't picture, oh, like 25 years later, I'm going to watch this with Marty Jannetty, and he's going to tell me everything. You know what? It's possible that it was real glass. It is. If you think about it, if there was a barbershop set that in the glass is not meant to break, and like that's the proper kind of wall that's there for it, and maybe they were supposed to switcheroo and they didn't, this one's hard to believe. It seems like a wrestling kind of tale. I don't know if I buy this one.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like an insane concept to have a real glass window. Like, what possibly would you need that for?
Unless you're Jungle Boy.
Oh, no.
I think what Stu said kind of made me think of something, I guess. You know, the idea that they built the barbershop set without conceiving that one day someone's going to go through the window. And so they had a standard barbershop set with real glass. And, you know, the word was, hey, tonight we're doing something different. Make sure it's sugar glass. And somebody didn't get the memo. But I think Marty could stand to sue somebody, man. He certainly looks like he needs the money.
I just think if that were real glass, he'd be so much more fucked up than he was. And it seems like a perfect opportunity for him, you know, to get out the blade, you know, when he's hanging over the edge there and, you know, little snip, snip.
I mean, also too, like, he goes through it pretty easily. I mean, I don't know how easy it is to go through a plate glass window, but I mean, at least head first and stuff, but I don't know. It does seem to go pretty easily, but Jack also makes a good point about the fact that it's not breaking into a million pieces. It's still that giant.
It was like a big bang when he goes through it. You know what I mean? Like, you even see like kind of Brutus, kind of like, you know, everyone's sort of like, whoa.
Yeah. It does look brutal. Yeah.
The WWF had a camera on the other side. Like, he wouldn't have had time to blade. Now that I'm thinking back, like, they showed a replay from the other side of the, you could see him go through the window from the other side.
Unbelievable.
Well, then he falls to the ground. I don't know.
It's funny. That's where Marty puts us, right? He puts us in this kind of neutral zone.
This is exactly where Marty puts us. He wants us in that gray area.
But that's the magic of wrestling, guys. That's why we love it. It's like, you watch wrestling, you know it's a show, but you're like, okay, but that was real. Okay, but that really hurt. Like, that's the reason why we watch it, is for those moments where it's like, wait a minute, that was not supposed to be like that.
What happens too is when you're involved in something that's so famous and so well remembered, like this barbershop heel turn from Shawn Michaels, you know, you're always asked about it. Everywhere you go, everyone asks you, all the fans you meet ask you about that moment. And so, you know, the wrestler wants to have a story worthy of the moment.
Yes.
It's
yes.
like Hulk Hogan's version of slamming Andre has like evolved over.
He's tearing his back in half now. You're right.
Brother, I don't even know the finish, brother. I didn't even know the finish till I got out there, dude.
It's on now. I mean, Marty and Sean are certainly Splitsville, and so the feud develops, as you can imagine. And the secondary championship in the WWF, of course, being the Intercontinental Championship, where a lot of guys on their way up to the top of the cards take a pit stop and kind of show their wares. Shawn Michaels is destined for that championship, and he's going to feud with his former Rockers tag team partner, Marty Jannetty, over it as 1992 bleeds into 1993. And the first time they meet, or at least the first time they meet in a high-level live broadcasted match, is the 1993 Royal Rumble in January of 1993. They have a matchup, and of course it's highly anticipated because Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty were excellent high flyers. They were great acrobats in the ring. They could do some really cool stuff. So the fans' mind and the WWF brass's mind start turning about what these guys might be able to produce in the ring. And by the time they get back through the curtain that night, WWF honcho Vince McMahon is not so thrilled, according to Marty Jannetty, with how the performance went. And we've heard similar recollections from Shawn Michaels as well. Of course, where they both diverge is who's to blame for the match perhaps being underwhelming. So let's hear Marty explain sort of where the blame seemed to be placed to his memory for the matchup and details that led to Marty actually getting back into the good graces of the WWF and winning the Intercontinental Championship shortly after it seemed like they had ruled that possibility out.
Sitting there, he's like, well, I heard that you were...
This is Vince McMahon, by the way, that Marty's talking about.
Been drinking some yesterday, and that must explain the match. I'm like, I wasn't drinking nothing. He said, well, I was told different. I said, well, he talking to me. He goes, really? There's a decision has been made, and I'm going to let you go. And now I'm about to cry. I'm like, what? What the hell is going on? I'm thinking it's because of a bad match. And I said that to him. I said, you're going to let me go over a bad match? If you're going to fire somebody for a bad match, you need to go out there and fire about 60 people. And then he's, decision's been made. There's nothing you can say. We mean there's nothing I can say. I mean, you're telling me I was drinking. That was the reason the match went on. You wanted. So about 2 months go by, and Kurt Henning calls me. You know, Kurt and I are very good friends. Mr. Perfect calls me one night, and you know, figuring, okay, Kurt's partying. I don't mind talking to him. Hey, get on the phone. Jannetty, I got your job back for you. And I'm like, oh, Curtis. You know, Kurt's a big river too. And I'm like, no, Curtis, it's...
Ribber being a term for a practical joker.
Not funny. He goes, no, I got your job back for you. Vince is right here. We're in the limo. He was riding. Vince always has a limo. And he said, I'm here with Vince. And then Vince was telling me about you, and I told him. He said he wished he didn't have to let you go, and he told me why he had to let you go, and I told him that's not true. Because Kurt was with me the night before also. He goes, I told Vince exactly what happened, and I didn't even know this. I said, well, what's exactly what happened? Well, Sean passed out in his food the night before and had to get to taking the 911. The paramedics had to take him. He had taken so many pills and drank so much, he passed out in his bowl of soup or something. I think they said he had clams, white clam chowder stuff. He was passed out in it, boiling bubbles. and that the 911 had to get him. And Kurt said, "You can call the hospital and prove this." And it was Sean that was all fucked up. And that is why they brought me back. And that is why I beat Sean, because Vince was irate that Sean had lied to him.
I got to ask Stu here. So we have a situation where the episode, you know, it frames up a pretty interesting moment where Shawn Michaels, everyone knows later on, became a born again Christian and was trying to recruit people he worked with to find religion. And Marty went out to a retreat with him and was baptized. And, you know, it's supposed to be sort of like this moment where all is forgiven between the two and things are, you know, demons are put back in the closet potentially. But Marty, I mean, in every story, Stu, that where Shawn, you know, compares favorably to him, he's got some story about, it seems, how Shawn was equally culpable in terms of, you know, drug use or whatever the case may be.
That's what makes this whole story so fascinating and so confusing. And it's like, goes back to my like Netflix true crime kind of doc on this thing. It's like, if you ever watch The Staircase, like one episode, you're like, well, maybe he did it. Then the next episode is like, well, wait a minute, maybe he didn't do it. Like, that's how you feel about Marty and Sean throughout this whole interview. Because like you said, it's like, you're trying to get yourself in the mindset. Like, if Sean wanted to leave Marty, because Marty's always fucking up. And it's like, but Sean's also fucking up. Like, who do you believe? Whose fault is it? I don't even know if Kurt Hennig's telling the truth when he's calling Marty. Like, yeah,
he's passed away, by the way. So it's not somebody we could track down, which happens a lot with wrestlers.
Based on the history of what we know about Kurt Hennig, you don't even know if that story is credible. So it's really all over the map, but there's always a story, and that's the main thing. And it's always something. Like, Marty's given another chance and then he screws it up, or he, you know, something happens, gat. Then he's given another chance and another chance and another chance, and 15 years later, another chance. And he just can't seem to get it together.
Like, when the clouds part and it's like, you know, Shawn Michaels in his face in a bowl of soup, here's your opportunity, you know,
yeah.
Get in there. And then it's like, gat.
Well, it doesn't end for Marty. You know, it's just the world is not smiling favorably upon him, even though he's got incredible talent all the way out to 2005. In fact, the WWE, as it had been renamed, was still interested in using him. They did a moment on Monday Night Raw where Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty came out to the old music that JP mentioned before for the first time in years. And it was like the Rockers reunion, and it was really cool. You know, the fans were really with it, and Marty showed up ready to work. He really still had it in the ring. It was remarkable how good he was looking after all the years that he'd been out of the national spotlight. And WWE, you know, is interested in giving him an opportunity to really impress them, and they put him against Kurt Angle, who, if you don't know, is really one of the most gifted in-ring wrestlers to ever do it. And they have a match on a SmackDown taping that airs on television that's just absolutely awesome and really makes Marty look like he's as good as he ever was despite all he'd been through. And, you know, Marty being Marty, though, it's not going to end well. It's probably going to end in a phone call to police. And so what happens is he takes in the event, according to what he told Dark Side Cameras, he takes in, you know, that taping of that match when it airs on television at a bar in Tallahassee, Florida. A lot of people gathered around. People don't necessarily know that Marty is in the house watching the thing. He's just sort of observing others watching the match. He's there. Marty is with a girlfriend of his at the time, a wifey, if you will. And he's watching the match, and he's loving the reaction people are having in the bar or the way he tells the story to the match, and he's very proud of it. And then he's made. Suddenly they realize that Marty Jannetty is actually here, and oh my God, let's approach him, let's get autographs. Sounds like just a beautiful moment for Marty Jannetty, but by the time it's all said and done, his wrestling career in the WWE would effectively be over.
Gat!
They're like, no, oh shit, because everybody's looking and they're like, holy shit. And then so it's just packed around me. And, you know, autographs, and I don't mind at all. And she's sitting right here. But she's right here, and she's taking it in. She's just...
This is his girlfriend at the time.
She's amazed by it. She's never been around nothing like that. Signing away. Right at the end, comes the end of my wrestling career. Because the girl that had... Actually, she had been to the house several times with, you know, where Rod and I were... My friend there was staying. And they had a hot tub in the back where a lot
shit.
Of people get naked and jump boy. In. She'd been there, you know. I've already seen her neck and everything. She looked good, but I've seen you naked. Get out of the way.
All right, I want to clarify that, because the transcript made it clear. He said, "I've already seen you naked. Get out of the way." This is, of course, what he's saying in his own mind. He's trying to, you know, describe for us his body language around the girlfriend when he's approached by this former hot tub mate of his.
But no, I'm sorry. But so when she comes up and she goes, I didn't know you did that. Oh, my God. She goes, that is so amazing. Who can you sign my tit? Like,
the man said tit. Let's continue.
I say, I've already seen her naked, so it wasn't a big deal. Pulled her, you know, sign my tit. And I'm like, here's my girlfriend. I won't say her name again. Here's my girlfriend, wifey. And she goes, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. And she goes, hey, my name. And she wouldn't shake her hand. You know, I won't say her name again. Wifey wouldn't shake her hand. And I'm like, she's pissed.
She is pissed, too. And it ends up in a squabble between the two. It's a long, winding story. But basically, they go back to the house and end up having a fight. And by the time it's over, the police are called due to all the noise. And Marty is taken into custody.
Was he on parole?
He was on probation, I think. But you're leaving, like, you know, the car ride to get to that Kurt Angle match was like another one of those stories, like hitchhiking and drugs and da-da-da. And the fact that he was positioned, you want to talk about get, it's like he was set up to win here. You're in a fight match with Kurt Angle, and you couldn't ask for a better person to make you look great. And it's like, he, according to Marty, the storyline was supposed to be that, like, Shawn Michaels fights Vince McMahon at the WrestleMania, and, like, Marty is the one that turns on Shawn and becomes a member of, like, the corporation or whatever the storyline was. Like, that's Marty's version of what's supposed to happen. Wow. Of course, none of that happened. Because, you know, of what happens on this fateful night of Marty getting arrested yet again. It's crazy. It's crazy how many, like, you know, you do the same thing over and over again and you expect different results. Like, that's not going to happen. Like, he never really grows up or grows, you know. This is 2005 and he's still with the same thing and the same behavior and the same, nothing's changed.
Yeah, no matter how many chances he gets. JP, you remember that match, JP? That was phenomenal.
It was amazing. I couldn't believe how well he had done. And it was, I feel like you and I talked on the phone after that match. Cause I remember watching it and just being totally blown away by what I saw and that he could still go.
And this is another example, Evan, of like, we don't know what happened to Marty after that. I mean, if you read like the insider newsletters and stuff, you got an idea, but here he is telling the story and it's like, oh my God, this guy is just always ending up in the same position.
It's kind of interesting to, like, even what Evan mentioned, like, as much as he never evolved as his character, he was just Rocker Marty Jannetty. Like, he didn't evolve off screen either. Like, he stayed Rocker Marty Jannetty on and off screen. He never was not Rocker Marty Jannetty. And how many times can you get arrested with drugs and dancers and all this stuff before you, like, realize, like, maybe I should change my ways? Like, that never
occurred. No, because he's got the GAT fallback, and that's preventing him from doing anything.
Like a psychological evaluation that could unveil certain behavior attributes that Marty has going back to his childhood or the incident that I'm sure we'll get to that may or may not have happened at a bowling alley, you know, but there's a reason why he's, you know, it's hard to kick drugs in dancers. It's, I guess once you get that much into it, it's very hard to kick that combo.
And he does describe a childhood full of strife between his mother and father and his mother actually being quite abusive towards him and not necessarily the dad.
His brother was murdered by their neighbors, apparently. Like, and, you know, so it's probably maybe a reason why he had to tell big stories because it's all there. You just read that transcript and you can see, like, it paints kind of a picture to how we got here. But the issue is Shawn Michaels at least attempted to clean himself up and whatever methods he took, whether it's Christianity or whatever it was, he seemed to have evolved as a person. And it just didn't seem to go that way for Marty, sadly.
Yeah, the story you mentioned there, it was kind of like meandering when he told it, but he's got a story where his kid brother fell off of a boat while going out fishing with an adult relative, and ended up drowning. And the family, according to Marty, at least some members of the family ended up concluding that perhaps it wasn't accidental, that he ended up in a position where he was not only in the water, but underneath the boat fighting to resurface. So, but that's Marty. You don't know with Marty. You know, you don't know.
He is the Walter Mitty of wrestling.
Yeah. And Stu, you mentioned he's in a lot of pain. I just want to quickly mention this before we bring it home with our final piece of sound from the Marty Jannetty interviews. He's in a lot of pain, yet he seems remarkably good at talking in a peppy way that doesn't acknowledge the pain. It seems like there are sometimes he has to just stop in his tracks because the pain's too intense, but he's a performer.
I mean, there's a, you could look at it as a beautiful metaphor. I mean, his ankle was so fucked up, and he was wrestling matches on that for like 10 years. How? Ugh. Like the same way that like the red light is on our camera. It's like there's a switch that turns on in a performer that like all of a sudden the pain is gone. At some point, the pain was too much for him, and he did ask us to take a break, which obviously we gave him as long as he needed, where he did need to sort of like take off the bandage and let his like wounds heal, or what, so to speak. But yeah, at this point, Marty kind of needs to be medicated due to the – if he's at a 12 pain level, then there's pain management that is necessary. I don't think this is a – he's in a I'd like to think that he's not in a self-medicated space now, and he's just doing what he's trying to do to get better. But, you know, how do I know? I'm not there with him, thankfully.
But he had the gumption to you know, take you guys out to the river where apparently, you know – if he had done it in that OJ moment, the body would be from the aforementioned potential murder.
He didn't know the word hypothetical until I taught it to him.
Yeah, he liked that. He wanted you to tell him what that word was. He wanted
as
to put that
in. As soon as I taught him the word hypothetical, all of a sudden his whole demeanor changed. Now it was like he could use that word and he could say whatever he wants now, as long as he says the word hypothetical in it. Boy, did he like to use that word after that.
You're down at the river and he gets kind of nervous. All of a sudden, what were people looking at you? Like, what are you doing down here? What was that about?
Yeah. So like the area of town is like not the greatest area as it may have been back when it was a bowling alley. But yeah, we were definitely there with like our camera gear in a place where like people would probably like to love to take that shit from us. it was dilapidated building, you know, it wasn't the most savory of places, but Marty was at home in this type of place because in his years of going to score drugs in cities, like these are the type of places he had to go to get them. So he was quite comfortable where we were. But when you see Marty get nervous, that's when you're like, okay, well, maybe we should be nervous if Marty's nervous.
And, you know, Evan talked about the cinematic qualities of Marty Jannetty's story, his life story, his wrestling story, his partnership with Shawn Michaels, where he's at today. So I guess we should conclude with his Scarface closing scene, as far as I'm concerned. Now, he's not going down in a blaze of glory, but the guy who, you know, never was at a want for female accompaniment. Call them wifeies, call them girlfriends, call them strippers, call them whatever you want. Marty Jannetty decides at a certain point in his life that it's time to get hitched. He's going to the chapel and he's going to get married.
I'm just going to say, before you press play, get ready, everybody.
He deserves happiness.
And, you know, that's what I take away from it, too. Even if it's just, well, 4 days worth. It's time for Marty Jannetty's honeymoon.
And so we had the honeymoon. It was 3 days worth of great. I won't tell about the first night because we ended up doing some cocaine. She'd never done it and tried. And
I heard that, Stu. He got you on that one.
And she ended up liking it, like I said, because she liked it. So we ran out and went to get more. And Tanaka was staying at my house.
Pat Tanaka, a wrestler friend of his.
He'd already bought some because he borrowed money to get it. I knew that. I told him, well, get some more for me in case. In case. Sure enough, I called him, hey, you know.
In case.
Yeah, we're doing cases here. He goes, come on. We drove over there and... we did a lot of freebasing. That's where you cook the coke down and you smoke it. And he had already rocked it up. We called it rocking. He'd already rocked it up. So I'm like, well, shit. And I didn't mind. But she don't know. She wouldn't do that. She just wanted to, you know, do some. So, you know, and she wouldn't. She was like, no, let's just go back. Let's go back. I said, well, hold on. Let me go upstairs and make sure I left something up there. And took a couple of the little rocks with me. Went up there and hit a couple. And then I got a couple more and was going to hide them and put them in my bag and sneak them over there. Oh. Back to we stayed at Disney World, which was on the other side of Orlando. That's where the 3 day honeymoon, which actually outside of this, you know, when we were heading back in my car, in my damn Ford Explorer SUV thing, and she's driving and I'm got it in a little gym bag. And it's got the pipe, and it's got some of the little rocks in there, the lighter. And it's went around one curb, and it spilled over, and gat, once again, it came right out on the floorboard, and she can see it all. And she looks over, and she starts having a fit. I can't believe you did. And she got so mad, she starts snatching the wheel back and forth and lost control. We shot up in the yard, we didn't hit a tree, but when we hit the curb, it bent my damn axle end. And I had to drive back to the house. Was only right down there. So I got to drive back with the wheel twisted and shooting smoke up in the air and hoping the police don't come by. See that?
So romantic.
And pull back in the driveway. I'm mad at her for wrecking my damn vehicle. Hers was in the yard. We could have taken it. Well, we had to now, but I was like, fuck, just give me a minute. I went back inside to do another hit off the thing. And she kind of waited, and then she knew it. And she was blowing the horn. Pat's in the window already with the blowtorch smoking his with the curtains open and the lights off so nobody can see him. But you're just lighting up the whole fucking room with that blowtorch, and they're going to see that long Japanese hair just back there. Would you like this, looking around? But she started blowing the horn. He's going crazy, and he's like, man, goddamn, you got to make her stop. You got to go. Get out of there. Go, go. I said, all right. I went out there and said, stop blowing that motherfucking horn. And he goes, don't scream to make her zoned. And she got mad. And she started blowing the horn then and yelling out the window, they're smoking crack in there. They're smoking crack. And I'm like, all right, I'm gone, Pat. All right, we go. And so we got the hell on out and went to that. And the rest of the honeymoon was great.
Oh, my God. Dude, is there more?
There's more, of course.
That was 3 days. On day four, she's back to work at the this is what I wanted to get in, because the marriage lasts 4 days. On day four, I go to pick her up from her work at mortgage place. And she's in her little cubicle. I'm waiting outside, but 5 o'clock and she still ain't come out. So I'm thinking she might be closing the deal. Let me go get her and let everybody see the newlyweds, right? So I go up and they point and everybody's smiling and pointing down at her cubicle. And I go over there and she's got her back to me. And I'm just waiting for her to finish. I don't want to interrupt her. But I hear what she's saying, and she goes, yeah, I know it was sudden. We just thought it'd be the right thing to do. And I'm like, whoa, what the fuck? And she goes, no, I don't want to get together at the house this time. Let's just get a hotel room.
Uh-oh.
Because I was going to be out of town for wrestling that week. And she's making plans to fuck somebody. Fuck, it's day four. The honeymoon was great. Day one, back to reality, she's making plans to fuck around. And I never remember I said how high that felt that from the wedding day, how high, that low, man. I could actually feel something right in here just drop through the floor. I mean, that just, fuck. 38 years to get married, and it lasted 4 days.
Stu, any closing thoughts on Marty Jannetty?
Closing thoughts on Marty Jannetty. First off, like I said, charming guy. And he's somebody. And
good
we
guy.
All have. I didn't say good guy. I said charming guy.
I'm just kidding.
But we all have guys like this in our life that you kind of know what you're getting with them and you still love them despite. And I feel like Marty's that guy who gets unconditional love by the people who truly know him and probably deservedly so. He's probably a great time.
Sure.
You can see why he's loved by his peers and friends. But you can also see how he ended up where he is. And it's like until he makes an active change to do that, and it's not for me to, you know, judge him for that. It's his life. But as soon as he makes a choice to change the way his lifestyle is, even at this age, I do believe that there is a redemption for him because that he is still loved. Even the people we interviewed that talked about all the bullshit that he's been through and caused, they still say he would make a great coach. Or not. I don't know if he could be trusted to do so, but if he got to that hypothetical place where he could be trusted, I feel like there's room for a guy like him to have a redemption story.
JP, any closing thoughts on your favorite rocker?
I don't know what to believe. In the episode and in these unheard clips, he has really polarized me. And I have been able to empathize or sympathize with so many of the troubled people in the wrestling business. And I can't do it with him because I just don't know. I don't know what to believe. And but that's Gat for you, I suppose.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, it's all
Evan, the world according to Marty.
What's that?
Bring us home.
Maybe I was a fool thinking that doing this episode would get us closer to some form of the concrete truth. It's a little bit of a fool's errand, but I do think it's, you know, even though you don't like the takeaway of the episode, did he kill this guy? Didn't he? What's real? What's not? I think that's a little subjective, you know, in terms of even being truly important to the episode, because I do think, you know, it is a portrait of somebody who is lost. And, you know, that post wrestling career, that sort of post fame, post stardom, you know, is something that is a reoccurring theme, not only in our show, but I mean, you know, Mickey Rourke, the wrestler, you know, it's a trope that we've seen. And this story gives Mickey Rourke a run for its money, that's for sure. But it's just, you know, in examining how one does adjust to that life out of the spotlight. And I do think that this episode does examine the harshest version of that imaginable. Maybe not the harshest, but, you know, it's pretty hard stuff. So, yeah, for me, man, it was a wild ride. I do remember just one quick thing, like, you know, Stu, when we sent you and the crew out there to do these interviews, it was very entertaining getting the reports, you know, back, you know, checking the phone, like, are they still alive? What's going on? You know, and seeing, you know, what you guys were up to down there, and finding out too, like, you know, you guys would call me every night after the interviews, and the crew was so divided on what the truth was. I would say, like, you know, Stu, you were like, oh, this 100% happened. And then, you know, the camera guy is like, it's about 20%. And then what really intrigued me is that each day that would progress, the most skeptical member of our crew started slowly turning around to being like,
the way he told it, like, I've done enough interviews to know when someone's lying to me. You know, it's like it's like, how could he have all these details if it was a lie? Like, how could he? You know, you put the rock in his hand, and like, it's almost like putting the gun back in the killer's hand. Like, how? There's no way he's lying, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. But I just don't think that his explanation that it was for a wrestling angle, it does not make sense. And what makes sense is that this happened to him, because he told this story to people in the 80s, the 90s. This is not a new story.
That is the element to it. Before you say anything incriminating, Stu, that is the thing that is very puzzling about it. And I do remember folks reaching out to me after it aired, and that one line of when Al Snow says, "Yeah, that's what happened," and he told me in the 90s. Ooh, that's hard to mess with, you know.
But I mean, you know what really sums it all up, Evan, is that Marty is telling us all of these crazy stories the entire time, which are horrible over and over and over again, of just like highs and lows, highs and lows, highs and lows. And he's got a smile on his face the whole time. So what we're looking at is, as negative stories about Marty, are like war stories for him, that he likes, it's like his glory. And he wears the arrest like just as much as a badge of honor as winning the Intercontinental Championship. You know, it's like, it's all told with a smile, and, you know, it's almost like he's proud of that. He's still here to tell the story.
The species that is the pro wrestler, in so many ways. And, the storyline idea that somehow he was going to leverage this into a deal where somebody was, you know, a buddy of his who was getting into wrestling, the storyline would be that he knew what happened that day, and he's going to seek justice and chase down Marty for the prosecution he never received for this supposed murder.
Unbelievable. Because Marty's not running anywhere.
Yeah, well, that's true. Running from the truth, perhaps. I don't know. I'm glad, Stu, you jumped into the pool with him and not the hot tub. That's all I can say.
I could have been wifey.
Yeah.
And a remarkable episode. Somewhere Marty, certainly ready to go. And Evan, the reason we're talking about Marty Jannetty on this particular week is because it makes for some nice synergy with the next episode from season 5 of Dark Side, where we look at the career and the life and times of Brutus the Barber Beefcake. And of course, one of the most memorable, perhaps the most memorable moment of Marty Jannetty's career is getting his face thrown through the barbershop window, which was a segment that Brutus the Barber Beefcake used to host on WWF television in the early 90s. Tell us about what to expect from Brother Brutai.
That's right. Next week's episode, as part of season 5 of Dark Side of the Ring, is on Brutus the Barber Beefcake. And speaking of face that you mentioned, actually, this episode gets into a huge part of this episode gets into the absolutely devastating and traumatic cranial injury that he suffered in a wild parasailing accident. Wrestling fans may remember in the early 90s, where basically Brutus's entire face caved in and they had to reconstruct it. And it's always been this story that we've heard for so long about, you know, rumor of, but we went very deep with this. We actually looked up the surgeon that reconstructed his face and interviewed him. So it's kind of the, you know, dark side goes into kind of a, you know, medical, you know, true crime type of story, but it also gets into the history of Brutus, but also the relationship between Brutus and Hulk Hogan, kind of one of the, you know, great falling outs. They were the best of friends. They broke into the business together. You know, Hulk Hogan, kind of brought Brutus wherever he went in the wrestling business, and always kind of stood by his side. And this episode kind of also examines the falling out of their friendship. So it's a very interesting, unique episode. Of course, just learning the details of that parasailing accident, it was like, oh my God, this is television. This needs to be on television. It's very cheekily titled Saving Face, the Brutus the Barber Beefcake story.
We want to thank you once again for joining us as we try to surface some of these gems. There's just so many of them waiting for your ears as the weeks progress. For now, it's back to the vault for us, and we'll see you next time on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard.